You were a news person at WTMA when?
Well, it was in the 1950s.
Mid-50s, early 50s, late 50s?
Yeah, about mid-50s, I think. Jack Gale was the morning man, and I say that reluctantly.
And why is that?
Well, Jack and I have known each other for over 50 years, and we've worked there, and we also worked together in Baltimore. He is one of my dearest friends and closest friends, but we have never said a kind word about each other or to each other.
Oh, really?
Never. I mean, it's out of the question.
So you've got that love-hate thing going on.
Oh, yes. It goes on and on and on. And, Jack used it as a sense of humor. Even our wives finally caught on to the fact that we didn't hate each other, but he used it as a sense of humor. On the other hand, I didn't, because I just didn't like the guy. That's enough said.
Well, I talked to Jack before, and I can understand that.
Yeah.
No, Jack sounds like a mighty fine person.
He is that.
So where were you before you came to WTMA?
I was in Chicago, and I was doing, prior to the war, I was doing soap operas.
What do you mean, doing soap operas?
Oh, things like Jack Armstrong and The First Nighter and Ma Perkins and all the various soap operas.
So you were a radio actor?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I was in service. I was in the Navy on a destroyer, and we had the thing sunk in Okinawa. Came back and got into journalism. Right around that time is into the 50s when I decided to go to Charleston. My brother-in-law and his wife were living in Charleston at the time. And it was interesting because they had talked to a fellow at WCSC television. The guy said, well, hey, said, have him come in, because at those days, few people knew television, or they may have seen a camera at one time, and that was it. So they hired me. So the day I came in, that afternoon, I got a cab, told him to take me to CSC. They gave me an address. When I got there, all that was there was a bunch of dirt movers and a couple of construction guys, and they were leveling the ground for what would be eventually WCSC. So obviously it was months away before there would be any hiring. So I told the cab driver, I said, well, do you know where NBC's the radio is? He said, well, I think it's over in the Dock Street Theater. And he took me over there, and I went in and I talked to, this is on a Friday, it was on a Friday, and I met a guy by the name of Newt Smythe. I think at that time the TMA was owned by the News and Courier. And I auditioned for Newt, and he said, fine, don't call us, we'll call you, one of those things. And I went home, or back to my brother-in-law's where I was staying. And about an hour later, I got a phone call from Newt, and he said, look, he said, I'll make a deal with you. I said, what's that? And he said, well, he said, we're doing a remote at a dance at the Citadel tonight from 11 to 11:30. And I said, I just found out we haven't got anybody to handle it. And he said, if you'll do the remote for us, you can start working for TMA on Monday morning.
Wow.
And I said, you got a deal. He said, okay. He said, well, you'll be doing the morning shift. And he said, get over here, and there's a guy by the name of Jack Gale. He'll let you in at 5 o'clock in the morning. So the Monday morning, I went in, and I rang the bell, and he rang the bell and opened the door for me, and I went upstairs, and I said, hi, I'm Bill Evenson. He said, so, and walked away. And that was our first meeting.
Wow. So what was it like doing news back in the 50s on WTMA?
They had a fellow by the name of Bob Truer, who was the news director. They needed somebody to do the news with Jack on the morning show. I guess somebody that could get along with him.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently we hit it off, and it was an interesting thing. We had the UPI wire and the AP wire, and that was about it. And the rest of the time we made phone calls and dug up our own stories. And I started actually doing a lot of work on a national basis, even though we were doing just for the WTMA broadcast. But I was doing it on a national basis, and I was calling friends of mine from Chicago and Washington and, you know, that sort of thing. It worked very well.
So your newscasts were pretty much wire copy and local stories?
No. I wrote my own.
Okay.
I just got the background stuff from it and then would write my own. And basically, that's what made it different than the other stations, because the other stations obviously were using just wire copy.
Now, did you use actualities at that time, where you would call somebody over the telephone or go out and record somebody's voice?
Right, yeah. And I knew some people, of course, with a number of the stations in Chicago and some in New York, because of my acting background. And I was able to call them and get guys in their news staff to give me feeds and inserts and so on.
Probably sounded big time.
It had a flavor of like it, you know. I always said the only reason they brought me in was to boost Gale's ratings, you know.
So how many times an hour did you do the news? Was it just at the top of the hour or throughout the hour?
I did the top of the hour and the half hour. Jack went on, I think it was either 5 o'clock. I think it was an hour ahead of me. I think he went on at 5, and then my first newscast would be at 6, and my last one would be a 10.
During those days, did the WTMA news, did it all come locally, or did some of it come from a network?
Yeah, we did have a network feed, which was NBC, but they didn't want to use the networks during the time that I was on for the news. They'd rather have me do it.
Oh, that's nice.
So that was a nice pat on the back, so to speak.
What did you do after you did your last newscast? Was that pretty much it for the day?
Oh, I went home.
Oh, okay.
Or sometimes I had to go out and cover a story or something. The Civil Aero Patrol was very big down there then. I had a tie-in with them, so every time there was a plane down or a ship lost or something of that nature, well, I almost had a plane on call to go out and cover it. And we'd get actualities that way and so on. One of the interesting things, if you want to hear a couple of side stories.
Sure.
The AP had a guy by the name of Bill Otis, who was a top reporter. And he had taken prisoner by the Russians. And he'd been in jail for over a year and tortured and that sort of thing. And he finally escaped. So the AP wrote a series of 8 articles every Monday on his life story. It was a series of these articles. So I decided to take them and turn them into a radio script. And there was a guy, I don't know, he may still be around Charleston, a fellow by the name of Jay Mullen. He worked the afternoon shift. And Jay was good. He was a big, tall, lanky guy. And Jay had a mastery of accents. So I'd write this script, and I'd put him in. He would one time, I'd be Bill Otis, and he'd be the Russian guy torturing me and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Strangely enough, it picked up a pretty good following. We ran it every Monday. Well, somewhere between Friday night and Monday morning, or the day that the 8th and final chapter would come about, AP went on a strike. And subsequently, there was no 8th in the series.
So what did you all do?
Well, I wrote it from fiction, and wrote it strictly from my head, because I knew the guy had escaped. And I wrote it and put the whole thing together, and we acted it out, and nobody knew the difference.
I'm sure your version was probably better than real life.
Oh, to me, yes. But we had a lot of strange things happen in those days, especially working with Jack, because the management gave Jack and in turn me almost a free rein of doing what we wanted to do. And, you know, we didn't have anybody breathing down our necks, and the ratings were always high. There was a fellow, an account executive by the name of Ansley Cohen, wonderful guy. He was the voice of the sports announcer on the high school football game, certain games. And as the account executive, this one game, it was a very championship game going to be held in Somerville. Ansley was going to do the play-by-play, and I'd do the color, and he had sold out all 4 quarters. Well, the game was on a Friday night, and along about Thursday night, one of the typical Charleston hurricanes came through, and it wiped out all of our lines from Somerville. So rather than give the thing up, we scheduled the game for an hour later. And what we did is we hired a couple of motorcycle guys, and we would tape the game, give him the tape, he'd take off, and we'd tape the second quarter or half or whatever we were doing. And he would fly back to Charleston, give the guy the tape, the engineer would put the tape on, and he'd come back. In the meantime, the other guy was going down with the next tape. And we had it pretty well covered until we got into the fourth quarter, and somewhere along the line, because of the pavement, the road was very wet from the hurricane, and it was also raining then, too. The guy with the motorcycle, the tape, spun out and went into the swamp. And in the meantime, why, back at the ranch, as they say, all of a sudden the engineer is sitting there, you know, and he's reading one of these high technical things, as all engineers do, you know, the Knutton valve and the Ipton pin. And all of a sudden he hears this flap, 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 and the tape has run out. So he just reaches over and grabs any tape from the pile, puts that one on, and then we're back in the second quarter. And we never did finish the game because the time ran out, you know.
That's funny.
Oh, yeah. There were so many things that happened like that. There were just unbelievable things. I don't know what happened to Ansley, because he was one heck of a salesman. He was a great guy. He really was. He wouldn't give up the microphone for anything.
He was a mic hog, huh?
Oh, one day we were going to do a game. I think it's a Citadel game, and I hadn't been down there too long, and other than that night I did the remote, I had no idea where the Citadel was. He said, well, he said, I'll meet you in front of the Dock Street Theater, you know, like 10 o'clock or whatever it was, and time to get over there. I said, fine, on a Saturday. So I'm standing out in front, and all of a sudden his car comes around the corner, and his wife is driving, and Ansley's sitting there. He's got these big sunglasses on. And what had happened is he had gone to the doctor, and the doctor had put belladonna drops in his eyes, and he couldn't see.
Oh, because his pupils were dilated.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we get up in the booth, and he won't give up the mic, and he can't see the field. So we do the whole game, the whole first half anyhow, with him doing the game, and he can't see the field, so we got the same 11 guys on both teams. There's no substitution. And he finally got through to about the halftime, and his eyes start clearing up.
So how long were you at WTMA?
I was there about 2 years, and then WCSC hired me away. They wanted me to come in and do the 11 o'clock news on television and the 6 o'clock. A guy by the name of Harry Janaris was then the news director, and I think he went on to become one of the aides to your governor down there at the time. Then shortly after that, Drayton Hasty, a wonderful, wonderful guy, he hired me from CSC to go over to WSN. And I think that's where I had my most memorable experiences, was at WSN.
That was Channel 2.
Correct.
So you eventually made it to Channel 5 after all, after spending a couple of years at WTMA.
Yeah, right.
So how long were you at Channel 2?
I was there about 2 years, or less than 2 years, and then Jack went up to Baltimore. And about 3 months after he was up there, I got a call from him, and he had talked to the program director and talked them into flying me up to Baltimore and talked with their program director. And consequently, I was hired into Baltimore, which became a whole new series of strange events working with Gail again, because there again, we were given our own headway, so to speak.
Going back to Charleston and WTMA, do you remember what broadcasters were paid during that time? Do you remember what you were making at WTMA as a morning newsman?
As I recall, I think I started at $150.
That was pretty good for 1955.
Oh, yeah, because most of them were being hired for $75. And I think they hired me at $150 and paid my moving expenses. And then I went to 200, I believe. And I think that's what I was making when I was hired away.
Now, WTMA was a top 40 station at that time, right?
Yes, right.
And from what I understand, they pretty much owned the town.
Oh, they did. There was no question about that, especially after I got there. Well, Jack came along, too, you know.
Well, forget listening for the records. We want to hear that news guy in the morning. That's why we listen.
Well, another thing, too, Jack did two things that was unusual. He opened a record shop and called Hound Dog Record Shop. And on Saturday nights, he would do a slot from 12 to 1 in the morning called Hound Dog. And he had this screaming hound dog and, you know, all kinds of noise and hollering and one thing, because he did so many voices. People used to think on his broadcast that we'd had 8 or 9 people up in the studio, and he was doing all the voices. That's what they couldn't get used to. And then on weekends, during the season, he would bring in top record acts to the pier.
At Folly Beach, right?
Yeah. And that place was always jam-packed when he would put on these shows. He was the producer, the director, he was everything. The singer Jerry Vale, I know you've heard of him or not, but Jerry had so many top records and albums, it was ridiculous. Jerry had a mortal fear of flying and of storms. So one weekend, Jerry Vale was coming into Folly Pier, and Jack was in a real bind because of the fact that ticket sales had not been what he thought they were going to be, and he was running short. So we're out at the pier, and it was in the afternoon, Friday afternoon, when the plane came in, and they brought Jerry out to see this scene. So we're standing out on the Folly Pier, and Jack said, "He's wonderful to have you here, but I hope the weather's going to be all right." And, you know, then he started this routine thing. Those clouds out there over the ocean, they're worried about them. And he's given this whole thing. And Jerry now said, "Well, you think there's a storm coming in?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "I've seen it like this before. Heck of a storm came in, you know, like a few hours later." Well, the guy was scared to death. And just about that time, one of the guys that worked for Jack took one of these big garbage cans that was, you know, loaded with beer cans and things, and was behind the bar, and he dropped it. And that was all she wrote. Jerry Vale got out of his contract right then and there.
That's a great story.
Oh, man, it was hysterical. But he brought Elvis Presley in there.
Oh, really?
Yep. He originally had him booked at the an auditorium out there. I forget the name of it now. But anyhow, he had him booked there, and he realized that, my God, they couldn't handle it. So he made some quick calls and booked him into your ballpark out there, the baseball town.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he made 3 announcements. And all the tickets were shifted there. They were sold out.
Wow.
So he had a lot of fun. And he made it easy to work. Jack and I have often talked about Charleston. We both have a soft spot in our heart for it because it was not only where we really nailed each other, but the fact that where some of our best work seemed to work better there than anywhere else. And another thing, too, that was not just indicative of Charleston. It was done in Chicago. I think that's where I brought it into Charleston. I made a point to meet with the news directors of the other radio stations and the television stations. And I was not a news director at TMA. Bob Truer was. But I met with these guys, and we'd all go out to lunch and went there. And I finally got them into taking shots at me on air, and I would do the same with them. And it started a rivalry. And people would say, well, how can you say that about so-and-so and get away with it, you know? And I'd say, well, look what he said about me. You know? And we started this thing, and it worked beautifully. People fell for it, hook, line, and sinker, you know. You know, things like, you may have heard when so-and-so on Channel 5 announced last night that such-and-such and such, well, it's not completely accurate. And then you'd go on from there.
That'd be kind of fun to watch today.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and we had a lot of fun at WTMA with it. Nobody really, among us, none of us took it seriously, but the public did. They took it very seriously, you know.
By 1950 standards, what was WTMA's studio equipment and transmitting equipment like?
I remember. They had enough microphones.
At that time, were you all recording on reel-to-reel tape, or was everything done on vinyl?
No. It was all reel-to-reel, and the 45s had just come in, and the reel-to-reel was the big thing.
But still, you hadn't got to the point where you were using tape cartridges back in the 50s.
Oh, no. Not at all.
Yeah.
Well, they wanted me to do a Man on the Street show one time, and we did it in front of a drugstore down in Main Street there in Charleston.
King Street,
yeah. And it was a riot. I didn't mind doing it. It was, you know, get out of the studio for a while.
Now, when you all did news back in the 50s, did you have the teletype sounds in the background?
I didn't, no. I just opened the mic.
Were you in the same room as Jack or a different studio?
No, Jack was in the main control room, and then there was a little tiny studio. It was about big enough for a small desk and a chair and a microphone, and that's where I did the news. I could look out the window and look right down on the street in front. That's where we did the news from there, and then Jack would sit in there and make all kinds of comments in my earphones and anything to pass the time.
I guess at that time in the 50s, the radio dramas, the soap operas and stuff were dying because TV was taking over?
Yeah, it was getting to be to that point. It was one of the reasons I got into journalism. Is when I left to go into service, there were something like 15 or 18 soap operas coming out of Chicago. So actors were working a lot. But then things moved to L.A. or they moved to New York. And when I got back, there was only 11 shows coming out of Chicago on NBC, and all but two of them were audience participation, like game shows.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, they had just started ABC, too, which was the old Blue Network of NBC.
Mm-hmm. They had to split the Red and Blue Networks. Yeah,
right. So that's how I got into journalism. I sort of liked it. You know, I liked the adventure of it.
So the old-time radio days, if I could just visit that, because that's way before my time. I've heard the transcriptions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what was a typical day like for you? Like, I assumed you did one show a day?
Yeah.
Probably out of what, WMAQ?
I did a couple of shows a day. And then also I did, generally on a Friday night, I would do the First Nighter or one of the half-hour drama shows. Because the soap operas were 15 minutes then, and we would get paid for 1 hour rehearsal and 15 minutes on the air. And I was doing Scattergood Baines, for example, and because in some cases, if you were covering, like in Scattergood's case, you would do the show which took the Midwest and the East Coast, and then you would play the big vinyl for the West Coast.
Oh, you didn't do it twice, you just did it one time.
Right. Some of them we did twice, but many times they just used the vinyl record. That was the way the thing was going at that time. So your day, you'd go in, you'd work an hour and a half doing the show, and if you were only doing one show, that was it, other than the fact you were looking around trying to find where you were going to get the next show. You know.
Were they difficult to do?
It just depended on, a lot of things. It depended on who the actor was or the actress that you were working with, how good everybody was, how well it was written, you know. I belonged to the Radio Legends, and we'd recreate shows periodically, maybe four a year, at our luncheons. And invariably, we bring in some of the people that were on the original shows, like the Lone Ranger and stuff like that. And it's amazing, two things, how corny the scripts were, and secondly, how diligently you had to stay with the script. You know, you couldn't wander off, primarily because of the time. They're interesting to do, but you wonder why people would accept them. But there were so many people out of Chicago. Chicago was the foundation of radio, and that's why you still have today what they call the Chicago sound. So unless it's called for, there are no accents in your actors. So many great performers came out of there. I remember Charlie Flynn, who was Jack Armstrong. He took over the Jack Armstrong role after Don Ameche, and that was out of Chicago, of course. And I used to work his show occasionally. And we did a recreation of one of the episodes of Jack Armstrong here. And I was having lunch with Charlie. He lives in San Diego, and he flew up here for it. And he said, "Do you remember anything about it?" I said, "There's only one episode I remember." I told him about it as being lost in the jungle with Uncle Jim and Betty and Billy and himself. There was a son of a chief in the jungle that came out and befriended us and found our way back to civilization or whatever. And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I remember that." He says, "Do you know who the chief's son was?" I said, "No, it was Tyrone Power." And that was one of his roles.
Mm.
So, as I say, there were a lot of people. John Hodiak played Little Abner on radio in Chicago. And the only reason he got the part was he looked like Little Abner.
Which is very important on radio.
Pardon me?
That's very important on radio.
Yeah, right. As Jack used to say at the close his show, he always gave credit to the engineers and the directors and me and everybody. And he would, he'd always say, "Make up for radio by Max Factor."
I guess you all did those in front of a live audience?
Well, some did. The soap operas, no. But like the First Nighter, the First Line, which was the Navy show as the war broke out, those shows were done in front of an audience.
So you had to be concerned about the audience as well as your performance on the air.
Yeah, right, right. And for whatever reason, I don't know, but for years, we used to have to wear tuxedos to do the broadcast. I don't get the reasoning behind it, but it was quite interesting, you know. But a lot of them went through the mill, so to speak. And
any of the folks that you work with on the radio doing those soap operas make it to TV?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, quite a few of them did. I think the first time that I got involved with television was a variety show for Zenith. Believe it or not, that was in 1939.
Wow.
And a long time ago.
But 15 people could watch it, probably.
Yeah, you were lucky if they all were home. That was before they had water-cooled lights. And there was a state law in all the states, you could only work 15 minutes at a crack, and then you had to take 10 minutes off. So if you did a 30-minute show, it took you 40 minutes.
Oh, I see.
Because the lights would kill you. You know, you couldn't see for a week.
They were really hot, too, huh?
Oh, yes, they were hot. They were hot. We had more guitar strings pop and curl up because of the heat.
Were they actually hotter than film lights?
Oh, yes, much.
You needed to have more light for the TV cameras?
Exactly. And the damn cameras, you know, it was like pushing a truck around. They were gigantic, which was one of the interesting things when I went down to Charleston. I think CSC was the second television station in the state. They had taken some people, four or five people, and took them up, I think, to New York to let them observe the CBS television studio and the cameras and so on. And that was about the only experience they had when they came back and suddenly they were working the cameras, you know, and the sound stuff. So it was a real situation of just trying to get through a learning on-air experience for our technical people, you know.
Luckily, not too many people were watching at that time, so they had time to prepare before everybody bought their TV.
Well, yes and no. It was such an unusual thing that practically every store had TV in the windows. And every family that could locate a television set and buy one had one. Sometimes they would look at it and sit there and stare, and all they were seeing was some woman teaching them how to iron a shirt or something, you know, some stupid show like that. But it was such a fascinating thing to see that they just couldn't get enough of it. You know, they would come to the studio and they'd want to know if this is where the wrestling was done, because they carried wrestling shows, or if this is where whatever shows were being shown on syndicated, if that's where they did them. They couldn't get it through their head that it was being done out of Chicago or New York or L.A. or something, and these were tapes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, there were more. There were kinescopes. So it was quite interesting, to say the least. I was lucky to be involved in so many things through five presidents. I covered every space yacht from the very first all the way to the walk on the moon. And either I was down at the Cape or I was out on the recovery ship. So there's a lot of stories and a lot of information.
Great time to be alive and be in this medium we call radio.
Yeah. It's like the Chinese say, may you live in interesting times.
And you certainly have.
Yeah, we do.